and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road of wrestling history, up and down the Smoky Mountains, as it turns out, and beyond. This week here on the Studcast, but without any further ado, let's get to the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. And Ron, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. Man, I'm so stoked today. I'm really enjoying this Southeastern stuff now that we've finally gotten into where I own a company, and I think we got a great one for him today. It's going to be a fairly long ride. We're going to get into a lot of different things today.
You teased it a little bit at the end last week saying that you're going to talk about the big angle with your secretary. I know we're excited to hear that, but I said it at the top, the Smoky Mountains and beyond. You're all over the place still, even though you are the owner and the booker in a territory.
Yeah, I am. We're going to get into that this week. You know, I'm going to work basically in three territories. If you count mine as a territory, it's not territory yet. It's just a town. But it's going to soon be a territory, and I'm going to be in three territories in this program, and wrestling a lot of different great talent still, kind of like being in St. Louis in a way.
And just to remind all the listeners where we are at the beginning of 1975, January and February of 1975, we're going to cover this week on the show. And without any further ado, Ron, I'll kick it right over to you.
All right. So, yeah, we're going to go, like I said a second ago, we're going to take a long ride today. I hope old Lightning's ready. We're going to cover a whole lot of ground. We're going to talk about January and February of 1975. And I will be wrestling in three territories at the same time. Just mentioned that a second ago. I'll be also cutting a deal that starts the beginning of my own territory. I'm going to be dealing with a television commentator that doesn't have an understanding of who the real stars are on the show. Which that's a big problem. Going to be figuring the first great angle that I book as an owner of Southeastern Wrestling with Ron Wright and my secretary. And finally, if we get to it, we're going to talk about the Friday night card. The first Friday night, I think it's the 7th of February in Knoxville for Southeastern. So, let me just roar right into it, man. I began in 1975. I opened the year as the new Southern Heavyweight Champion, won the belt on December 29th, 1974 in Memphis in a one-night tournament. I'm defending the belt quite a bit. Not in the early month in January, but quite a bit more in February. I'm going to defend the belt four times in the month of January 1975. Three times going to be in the Memphis territory against Tommy Gilbert, against Jerry Lawler, who's going to be managed by Sam Bass, and then Memphis, and then once in Louisville versus Steve Kovac. And then I've gotten a great heel. I'm getting really the feel for being a heel, and I'm starting to really get over in Memphis. And so the Tommy Gilbert match almost sells out the Mid-South Coliseum. The next week I work for the Southern title against Jerry the King Lawler, and that does sell out the Coliseum on that Monday. The Louisville Garden Show is going to be in February, but it's going to be a huge sellout for them. It'll be my first time to ever go into Louisville since 1971. I made a little short trip out of Florida in 71 to visit my brother, spent a week in the territory with him, and I worked Louisville. That's the only time I'd ever been to Louisville. So it's my first time to ever work Louisville since 1971, and it's the third Southern title defense that takes place. And, you know, I take the third title defense is actually in Studcast number 87, and that was against Bill Watts in that world championship event in Knoxville just 2 weeks earlier than what we're talking about with this particular episode. So in February, I'm going to successfully defend it 10 times. I'm going to really start wrestling with the belt for just about every match. I'm going to defend 6 times in the Memphis territory, 4 times in Memphis itself with Dick the Bruiser, Steve Kovac twice, and Phil Hickerson once. In Louisville, I'm going to defend twice, once against Tojo Yamamoto and another time against Steve Kovac. I'm also going to defend the Southern Heavyweight title in Roy, my grandfather's Roy and Nick Gulas' Tennessee territory in Chattanooga. That's their town, against Jerry Lawler. So 3 times in Knoxville versus Lou Thesz, one of those times, and twice against Ron Wright. I mean, I'm really starting to put it out there. And some of these guys are classic guys, Dick the Bruiser, Lou Thesz. I mean, these guys are geez, you know, you're taking a real chance and you defend the belt against those two guys because you may not walk out of the ring with it. So, and I guess the unbelievable part about selling out in Memphis for me was is the fact that I really never worked on the TV live there during my entire run in Memphis. And that's most unusual. I don't know of anybody in any territory that ever was the top heel that never, ever worked the television live. And that's what happens in Memphis. And so I'd always been working. The reason I couldn't do it is because I own Knoxville, and I did my TVs on Saturday, and Memphis TV was recorded on Saturday. Well, Tennessee's about 400 miles wide, so, you know, there's no way you're going to be in Knoxville and in Memphis on the same day. So they shot their matches. What they did is they shot their matches live on 16mm. On Monday nights in Memphis from the Coliseum, and then they showed them back on the TV the following Saturday. So that's kind of like me being live on television. It may be even a little better because they're seeing a huge crowd, and it just makes the event and more exciting, and it makes it more important to the viewer out there. It's like, wow, where is this coming from? Well, it's actually coming from the Mid-South Coliseum. And then at the same time on those same nights, I would do an interview with Lance Russell after the match talking about my next opponent that I'm going to be wrestling the following Monday. So it gave them the opportunity on that Saturday to show me in a live match from Mid-South. And it also gave them an opportunity to see a live interview basically shot after the match. Now, the fans don't know when they shot, but it doesn't make any difference. The fact is I'm getting that exposure that I need to get on that television in order to be able to continue to draw the big houses for them. So I really thought this wouldn't work. Actually, Jerry Jarrett, it was his idea. He said, Ron, you can't be there. I understand. Why don't we do this? And that was his suggestion. And it really helped prove to me the importance of video footage each week with live matches from your big house events. It also gave me the opportunity to work angles in arenas as well as on TV. So the Memphis TV show also aired in Louisville. And then the next Saturday after Memphis, what they would do is they would record that show in Memphis on a Saturday, and the following Saturday it would air in Louisville. So while I'm becoming a star in Memphis, I'm also becoming a star in Louisville, although I've not gone to Louisville since I started wrestling in Memphis. It's an odd situation, but for some reason it worked.
Ron, real quick, a question, even though it's not necessarily related to this time period, but I hadn't thought to ask you before. Memphis wrestling, for so many people, especially after Jerry Jarrett took it over, they remember the opening there is a statue of two guys grappling that spins around while 2001 plays. You had a very similar statue on Southeastern Wrestling. What is the origin of this statue that you had and Jerry Jarrett had both on your television shows?
Well, the first time I ever saw that statue is my dad brought it home back in the 60s. And he had found it someplace. And it's actually a Greek statue. It's two Greek wrestlers in the Olympics. They don't have any clothes on. Now, I don't ever understood that part of it. But maybe that's the way they wrestled back in those days, 2,000 years ago or whatever it was. You know, I mean, it was crazy. But that was something that my dad had in his home. And I always loved that statue. It just said wrestling to me. You know, it's one guy on his hands and knees, and basically the other guy is trying to get a grapevine and he's reaching over and grabbing an arm. It's a wrestling statue. And I just couldn't wait. If I had a business someday, I always promised myself, if I ever get my own territory, that's what I want to do with my wrestling show, my television show. And we used it as well. And you put it on a turntable, and basically it just slowly turns around during the course of when you're cutting whatever you put under it, you wanted to advertise it. They used it a lot. Once I go to the bigger TV, they love that statue. They got the idea and the concept, and they pushed it big time for me. They cut spots for me regularly with that statue. It became synonymous with Southeastern. And as you said, Jarrett used it as well on his program.
So is it the same statue that Jarrett used, or is it two different statues?
Two different statues. So somewhere he's got the same statue. He finds the same statue, and I'm able to talk my dad out of that statue and told him what I wanted to use it for. And he says, well, you know, that's pretty unusual. He goes, well, that's a pretty good idea. So, you know, I said, Dad, it really is synonymous with wrestling, and I want to use it. It'll make sense, because that's what I'm trying to develop over there, is I'm trying to develop people into wrestling fans and have an appreciation for wrestling. So, Chattanooga. Now, we mentioned Chattanooga. Chattanooga was owned by my grandfather, Roy, and his partner, Nick Gulas. Now, they're running an old style. I'm going to call it an old style wrestling company at this point, where all their TVs are still live. They don't shoot any live film from a house show, nor do they tape their shows and bicycle them around the territory, as Jarrett was doing, and like Florida did, where they had to bicycle that tape to all the markets in the state of Florida. Well, they're still old school there. Chattanooga has its own live TV. Birmingham has its own live TV. Nashville's got its own live TV. It's just kind of a mess to try to do these live television programs in three different states at the same time. It's just really, really difficult, and it's just not smart. So they're still doing the old style, though. So they didn't record any interviews from the building to use them on the next show in Chattanooga, like Jarrett was doing in Memphis. And even with getting that little or no television exposure in Chattanooga, every time they booked me there, I would sell it out for them. So, you know, they kept booking me, and, you know, but I'm not going to work in Chattanooga very long, because I want to start running my own towns on Saturday nights. And that's when Chattanooga always ran. It had always been a Saturday night town, a great wrestling city it was. And so I want to get my own Saturday night towns running, and I'm only going to work in Chattanooga basically through January. I'm not going to work much in Chattanooga after the month of January 1975.
Hey, Ron, if I could ask you a question about Chattanooga. Yeah. Obviously, when people talk about wrestling in Chattanooga, for so many, the first name that pops into their head is Harry Thornton. Did you get to know Harry Thornton well?
Not well, no, because I had never been there a whole lot. I was there in 71 when I made that week with Robert. We worked in Louisville on a Tuesday. We worked in Chattanooga on TV, and we worked a house show in Chattanooga that week that I was there. But I really didn't become friends with Harry. I was introduced to Harry, and, you know, very nice to him. And, you know, he was a very nice guy. I was impressed with Harry. He was a sharp guy. And, you know, he had a great town. His city was an always a spectacular wrestling city. And I guess that's one of the reasons it was selling out. You know, even with me not being on TV, people just love their wrestling in that city. And that's what I wanted to develop in Knoxville. I wanted to get that type of impact in Knoxville. So, you know, since we're talking about matches during these 2 months in early 75, let's talk about the special matches during that same time frame. The first of them was in Memphis on January 20th, 1975, and the next was in Louisville the following night. The first match is a rare tag match for me. During this time frame, after I become the Southern Heavyweight Champion, I don't wrestle in many tags. I don't think this may be the only tag I wrestled in the two-month period of time in January, February of 75. And I wrestle, my partner is Danny Hodge, of all guys. And gosh, what an honor it is to wrestle and just to get in the ring with Danny, whether you're wrestling him or a partner with him. And we're going to wrestle in Memphis on the 20th of January 1975 against a team of Dick the Bruiser and Jerry Lawler. Pretty spectacular team. It's one of the few times I'd ever worked partners with Hodge. And it was also one of the few times I ever saw Danny heel. I was a heel, and they put Danny in there with me as a heel, and he got great heat. He started resorting to my tactics. He was throwing a few punches. He was even doing some choking at one point, and I was like surprised he was really like following my lead, since he had that much more experience in the ring than I did. The end of the match, I ended up with a full Nelson on Dick the Bruiser, and I held him up for Hodge to knock him out. And Hodge could definitely knock you out, that's for sure. I mean, he was a fabulous boxer as well as a wrestler. But Bruiser ducks, and Hodge hits me on the chin. And I mean literally hit me on the chin. And I don't know if fans are aware, but, you know, Hodge was not only an Olympic wrestler, he was an Olympic boxer as well. And believe me, he could throw a punch. And the one he hit me with put me down for real. I think I was really out, because I remember the punch coming, and the next thing I remember is looking up at him, and he's bent over me, and it's after Bruiser's pinned me, I guess, and he's apologizing to me for being so stiff. He's going, "Ron, I'm so sorry. Gosh, I got you a good one." Yeah, you did, Daddy. You got me a really good one. So it was a great finish, and it set up perfectly for a Southern title defense I've got coming up 2 weeks later with Dick Bruiser in a singles match there. So Danny worked Knoxville for me four times during that 2 month period of time. And he would work for me four more times in the month of March alone. So I really am loving this experience of being a partner with him and wrestling in a tag match with him. And during this 2 months, we really get to create a relationship, a really great relationship between me and Danny in the first 3 months of 1975.
You have three guys in there who are tremendous in-ring workers, you, Jerry Lawler, Danny Hodge. Dick the Bruiser was a different animal altogether. I'm not saying he wasn't a great worker, but it was a different style of work. He was a different style of wrestler. And he was much older here than he had been when he became a really big star in the mid-50s. What was it like for you to work with Dick the Bruiser at this period of time in 1975?
Whoa, hard, difficult, you know, and like you say, he's got a little age and he's never been a great wrestler. That was not his forte, you know, it wasn't what Dick was all about. But it was a great experience for me. I love to wrestle with the big names, and I'd never had a chance to wrestle with him. And I get this opportunity twice, as I said, in tag match in January 20th. And 2 weeks later, I'm going to wrestle him in a match by myself. And that match, probably not as good as some of the matches I had there in Memphis. But it's still a great match because you're wrestling a legend, and most people, you know, even back in those days when there wasn't a big cross between televisions and talent wasn't switching territories all the time, everybody knew Dick the Bruiser because of wrestling magazines, and he was big in the magazines.
You said you had a couple special matches. That was one. What's the other one?
Well, the second one, man, I want to talk about is the next one. I said I was going to wrestle two nights in a row. Well, the first one was the tag match with Danny in Memphis. And the next night, I'm wrestling for the world championship in Louisville against Jack Briscoe. And Jerry Jarrett and I had discussed from the very beginning that I was just basically going to work Memphis only for him. But since his TV is going to Louisville, and since I'm getting over so well for him in Memphis, he starts begging me. He says, you know, Ron, can you just work Louisville for me just a couple of times? I just kind of want to see how you do up there. So I was on all those TVs beginning November 30th of 1974 that go right into Louisville. So this meant I'm becoming a star in Louisville. And I'm on every one of those TVs for 5 weeks straight by the end of 1974. That means, you know, like I said, I'm not just getting over in Memphis. I'm getting over in Louisville. So when Jared asked me to work a show for him, I tell him, yeah, sure. Go ahead. Book me. I'll come in there on the 20th of January. Book me in Louisville on the 21st. Well, he didn't tell me who he's going to book me with. And I didn't cut an interview even for it. And I get there. That building, it's the old gardens there. And it is packed. I mean, it's to the walls. And I go in the dressing room, and there's my old buddy Jack Briscoe, man, now world heavyweight champion. And it's like a homecoming for me, man. You know, just great to see Jack. And so this match is just not there to get me over. I mean, he didn't send me over there and give me a win and get me over. He sends me in there and puts me in the ring with the world heavyweight champion. So, and Jack was like a mentor to me in Florida. He was a special wrestler for me. I just really loved Jack, and we had a tremendous relationship. So this is going to be the first of four world title matches I'm going to have with Jack Briscoe in the first 4 months of 1975 in three different cities. This match was awesome. Because we wrestled, and Kasha, I loved wrestling with Jack. He was just a consummate professional as far as wrestling was concerned. And he did not throw a lot of punches. He liked to use the forearms. He was a different style. He was a little bit like Dory Jr. in a way, you know, lots of wrestling, forearms, not a lot of punching, not a lot of healing, but he had so much charisma and he had so much pure wrestling ability. It was hard to not have a great match with Jack. And Jack made me look great in this match, as he did every one of these four matches that we're going to have in the early part of 1975. And he's going to win by disqualification. He's not going to beat me in the middle. That was nice. I thought that was nice on Jarrett's behalf too. And so him not beating me my first night there in Louisville, it just gets me over more. So I'm going to go to Louisville and work Louisville nine times in 1975. I'm not going to go every week. I'm not even going to go once a month, but I'm going to pick my spots, and I'm going to let Jerry pick his spots and put me in there when he really wants to pop it big. And that's what kind of happens for him there. It worked out to be a great deal for him and for me.
Hey, Ron, real quick before we move on, and I want to know a little bit more about your relationship with Jerry Jarrett at this period of time, but you're talking Memphis, you're talking Louisville, even Chattanooga. Was Nashville out of the question because of your relationship or lack thereof with Nick Ulis?
That's an odd deal. I never, ever worked Nashville in my entire career.
And wow.
Never. I never had a single match in Nashville. I went to the matches there one night and watched. I think Rob was working and I wasn't on the card. I think it had a little bit to do with, the Knoxville situation, in which I kind of pushed Roy into letting me out of that booking contract. And it probably affected my relationship. Nashville was kind of Nick's baby, and Nick was kind of handling Nashville, and he would book who he wanted to in there. And obviously after I got out of this 10% booking deal in Knoxville, then Nick didn't care much for me, I don't believe. And I never, ever worked Nashville. That is kind of strange, isn't it? I mean, to work all the major Tennessee towns and a lot of the smaller ones too on both sides of the state, but I never had a single match in Nashville.
So let's go back to your relationship with Jerry Jarrett. You're working in Louisville. Talk a little bit more about it.
Well, I'm building a relationship with Jerry here at this point. And Jerry and I have never spent any time together. 1 week, 1971, I come through the territory. Jerry is not the owner at this point. He's not involved in it. He's not the booker. He's just a wrestler in 1971. But now we're kind of becoming good friends. And we start having discussions about his mother and his owning Johnson City, Tennessee, which is only about 100 miles northeast of Knoxville. And, you know, Jerry sits down with me one night in Memphis and he says, "Ron, you know, you got Knoxville going and you're doing good over there, amazingly well for just getting started. And we're having problems in Johnson City. We've been on that town for years, but we just can't get it to draw." So he needed some help there. And at the same town, I needed more towns to run in. And by having another television somewhere else in another market, that's going to help me with that situation. It's going to help me build toward being a territory. So we start discussing a way to help both of us. So we finally finalize a deal between me and Jerry and his mother. And she's the actual owner there. Jerry's just fronting for her, basically, and having this conversation with me. And we're going to become equal partners in the Tri-Cities of Northeastern Tennessee, but in Johnson City itself only. So I take over their television slot on Saturdays in Johnson City. They're on a NBC affiliate, and it's in early 1975. I'm taping my Knoxville show already. And this gives me a second market to use it in, like I was just saying. And therefore, I'm going to reach a larger audience and a totally different audience of what I'm into from my Knoxville station, because it's got that weak signal. So I send them a big old bulky 2-inch tape with the wrestling show recorded on it by bus each week to Johnson City to be aired the following Saturday after Knoxville has seen the show. So this was a big move for me and for my company, Southeastern Wrestling. It's going to open up many cities for expansion as my territory plans were in progress. I'm eager to build a territory here. I don't want just a town. I want a territory. The Johnson City station is strong signal. It's seen in Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, and North Carolina. My future plans are to run Johnson City itself every Tuesday night. But I know that eventually, once my talent is over, I can run all those smaller cities in every one of those states except for North Carolina. And that because it belongs basically to Crockett. Jim's been there. Jim Crockett Sr. been there for many years. He has a lot of respect within the NWA, and I don't want to step on his toes. I've got a little piece of the country that sits there between the Tennessee territory, the North Carolina territory, the Georgia territory to the south, and I can spread out a little bit there, but I don't want to step on anybody's toes. I think there's enough towns there for me to create a great little territory, and I'm happy with the opportunity to do so. The beauty of this arrangement is not only that I would only have to split the revenue for Johnson City. We're equal partners. So they get half, I get half. I send my wrestlers there. I send my tape there. They don't have to deal with it. And they're going to start making a lot more money than they ever made, because Southeastern's going to light up. And when it does, we'll be drawing in Johnson City what Jerry's drawing in some great deal larger cities. So I started to take advantage of this agreement, and I ran 5 shows in January and February of 1975 in Kingsport, which is one of the Tri-Cities, Kingsport, Johnson City, and Bristol. They're all about 20 miles apart. So we ran in Kingsport at a big old high school named Dobbins Bennett, and had a huge gym. So we didn't draw very well during January of 75 there, because nothing was drawing well. You know, it was kind of like Knoxville. When I came to Knoxville, it wasn't doing very well, and neither was Johnson City nor the Tri-Cities up there. It's going to take time. I got to get my talent over. But I know that when I get this TV situation going, I figure that there's probably 15 potential towns that I'm going to be able to run each, not each week, but one town a week along with Johnson City off of that television. That's going to help me to get to where I want to be. And as business grew, I'm able to run at least those 2 nights in that area. And, and I already had my eyes on another television station north of there in Bluefield, West Virginia, and that would give me an expansion even further north of Knoxville and even further into West Virginia.
Ron, to go back to this deal you made with Christine Jarrett and Jerry Jarrett for you to become half partners in Johnson City at this time, why would they make a deal like this with you if they owned the whole town? Was there any kind of deal they could have made, or was it you had to be 50-50 partners, and why did they do it?
Well, you know, that's a good question, Brian. I think they, you know, one reason is they lived in Nashville, okay? They operated a territory in western Tennessee. This town is in eastern Tennessee. It's 250 miles. Oh, no, I took that back. It's 350 miles from Nashville to Johnson City. And, you know, they don't want to send guys there. They want to focus on the western side of Tennessee. They got Louisville. They got Memphis. They've got Evansville, Indiana. They've got a bunch of nice towns and a pretty nice little territory over there. But this pushes them to run in the eastern side of Tennessee, and they really don't want to go there. Secondly, they haven't had any success there. I asked Jerry, I said, you know, what do you mean you're not drawing? And he goes, we can't draw. We just can't get over our guys over there. For whatever reason, we're not able to make that town go. So that's one of the reasons he wants to make this deal. And, you know, maybe there's another reason off the top of my head is I'm their top heel. And, you know, then I'm drawing them big money. And not only just in Memphis, now I'm going to Louisville and drawing them big money too. So they want me to be happy. And Jerry realizes that this might work out to be good. I mean, the kid's young, but he, you know, he's already showing some growth with his new company, Southeastern, over in Knoxville. And maybe this will turn out to be another good town, and we'll be able to get a lot more money out of it, only with half of the profit than what we're making now with all the profit. If they have a bad house, they're not making any money anyway. If I can take that town and make a big town out of it, they're going to make money, and they don't even have to go there or worry about it and deal with it. So I see that being probably the reasons that they had that in mind.
Were they using Ron Wright in Johnson City? Because most people don't consider Ron Wright a wrestler who worked for Jarrett, but were they using him at that time?
Yes, they were trying to use the guys that were over there in that area. But what had happened is there was a guy that was a great talent for them named Whitey Caldwell that had died in a car wreck about a year or a little more than a year, maybe even 2 years before I came to Knoxville. And he was so over that when he died, it hurt Knoxville's business. It hurt Johnson City and Kingsport's business. He was a star that couldn't be replaced. I guess that's what they were thinking, that he couldn't be replaced. But, you know, I come along and then I bring along a lot of other talent, and I don't think there's any star that can't be replaced. You just have to find somebody else that's a star and make them a star. And I think that had a big effect on Johnson City, and it had a big effect on Knoxville as well. I know that their business dropped dramatically after Whitey Caldwell's car wreck that he died in.
So you mentioned before how this would open your TV show up to new markets because you'd be getting it on new stations. Talk a little bit about your TV at this time. You've kind of teased it at the top of the show, the relationship or lack thereof with you and Big Jim Hess. Let's go into it, Ron. Let's talk about your TV situation at this period of time.
Okay. All right. You know, so he's my commentator. He's my Gordon Solie, supposedly. You know, he's my Les Thatcher. He's my Lance Russell. He's the guy that's going to make it happen for me. And I've mentioned to him several times, that I'm not happy with the way he's doing this. You know, and his name's Jim Hess. And in my opinion, he got headed in the wrong direction when he decided to call himself on the TV Big Jim Hess. You know, and I assume he considered himself big, but he was not big to me. I mean, not by my standards. And his size had nothing to do with whether he did his job correctly or not. My thoughts had always been about television wrestling shows that the show features wrestlers and not the commentators. And fans don't normally care who the commentator is unless they're particularly good at their job, like Gordon Solie was in Florida. Gordon never tried to upstage a wrestler on an interview or compete with talent in any way whatsoever. He did everything Gordon did added to the television experience for the fan. He could make a bad show good and fans not even realize what he was doing and that he was making it a better show, even though it had a bad match on it. So my less than wonderful commentator, Big Jim Hess, he could do none of that, nor did he want to, because he wanted to be the star. And the problem was, and I spoke to about him several times, I spoke to him about it, and we talked, and he was never, I said, you know, you're not wrestling on the card on Friday night. So why would I want you to be a star? And he answered me. He says, I remember his answer. He says, lots of people watch this show because I'm on it. So I said to him, I'm more concerned about the thousands and thousands of intelligent people out there that don't watch the show because you're on it. You know, I mean, that was the relationship we had. I didn't cut it. I didn't make it soft for him. You know, I let him know that, hey, I don't want you to be the star on my show because you ain't wrestling on Friday night. You're not even going to come down there, as a matter of fact. So what good are you if you're trying to be the star here? So I was already unhappy with the TV station because their signal was very weak. Their production crew was lazy and uncooperative. And when I ever asked them to do something special, I never got it. They were like, oh, well, we can't do that. No, we don't do that. We've never done that before. Well, that's not the answer I want. You know, I want somebody that can do it. When I move to the new station in Knoxville, I'm going to get myself the best little director in the history of wrestling. And when I tell him things like I told those people, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do this, I want to do that, he would say to me, I would say, can you do it? And he say, Ron, I can walk on water. And by golly, that boy did it. He walked on water for years for me, man. And Jim Hess could not walk on water, nor could he do anything to help me and my business. And then the worst part of it, he got that little phrase that he can't get out of his mind. You know, every time somebody throws a punch, he's got that voice, well, there's another warp your head off hole. Well, you know, that just, every time he said that, I wanted to go and strangle him. So things are not going to work between me and Big Jim. It's just the situation. That's where it's at this point. And he'd worked at that station. He actually worked on that television station. And I could see a big problem coming because I intended to fire his butt ASAP as soon as I could. And we're going to be discussing a lot more of this in the future, in future Studcast, and pretty soon about having a shootout over the Knoxville TV.
Well, before we get to that shootout, we will return in just a moment with details of the card from February 7th, 1975. But first, listen to this.
Super Studcast number 15 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast describes the stud's 10 most memorable matches. Fans are amazed at the detail Ron has put into every one of those 10 matches. Much more than just a description of matches, he breaks down events and angles prior to the matches themselves for a unique old school experience. These 10 matches contain a who's who of the sport for all fans and a wonderful ride through wrestling history at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for 3+ hours. Now, patrons can saddle up on Tuesday, April 9th for a Southeastern showcase with its award-winning wrestling program and host, Les Thatcher. This one will cover everything Southeastern created from 1974 until its sale in 1979. Incredible history in every Super Studcast.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 15, parts 1 and 2, Ron's 10 most memorable matches. People have been going crazy over this. Available right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. You can get in. The entry level is only $2.99. What better deal than that? And we want to thank everyone, all the amazing patrons and so many new patrons just recently have jumped on the Studcast, and we really want to thank everyone for that. And I guess we should announce here, Ron, Super Studcast number 16, which will debut on Tuesday, April 9th. We'll be featuring someone who kind of fits into this whole story here, one of the great stars of the sport and a future commentator for Southeastern Championship Wrestling, none other than Les Thatcher. This should be a really dynamic conversation. Les, right there next to you, Ron, when you guys were doing the TVs, he was your commentator. He introduced so many interesting new things into a wrestling television broadcast. This is definitely going to be a show that everyone wants to hear. Les Thatcher on the Super Studcast, once again, debuting Tuesday, April 9th. But before we get there, we'll have a little bit more information at the end of the show. I teased it before, Ron. Let's get to this card in Knoxville, February 7th, 1975.
Okay, so let's start out, Brian, talking about, you know, we go back to the same thing we talked about a little bit last week in the episode before. When you've got these, you're following these great cards. And now on the February 7th, we're following 2 weeks earlier, a world title card with a lot of stars out of Florida on it, a fantastic card. We follow that with Andre the Giant on the next card. The result is two of the biggest crowds back to back so far since I have started the company of Southeastern Wrestling. So, you know, basically now it's like, I put on my Booker hat, and now I say to myself, well, now what do I do? You know, I mean, again, we've talked a lot about momentum. We've created momentum here in the last 2 weeks, and I don't want to lose that momentum. So I'm not able to put together another all-star card, nor do I even want to, because I can't continue to run the town with just special cards and all these big names and all this big talent coming in every week, because I can't afford to do it. And they might not even draw as much as my own guys if I can get my own guys over. So I come up with the concept, and it's pretty plain to me that I need to draw houses, sellouts, like the two that I've had in a row with guys that I have. And now this is where I have to become a good booker. And this is where I've got to put on the booker hat. I mean, I got the promoter hat, I've got the wrestler hat, and I got a booker hat. And now I have to figure out how to put a card together that is going to sell out or draw another big house without anybody special on that card. That's pretty difficult. So in order to do that, I've got to come up with an angle. So we'll just go through that card real quickly. First match on that card on February 7th, 1975 was Rocky Smith against Devoy Brunson. Devoy Brunson is a local guy, a pretty good wrestler, but not a real great name or a great talent. Rocky Smith is the club-footed inferno. He is talent. He is very, very good. Can wrestle babyface or heel, doesn't make any difference. Can go out and give you a tremendous match every night. I'm lucky to have Rocky Smith involved. He happens to live up there in that Tri-City area where my TV just went in. It's going to be good for me that he is available to me. Next match on that card is Tommy Gilbert versus Tony Santos. I don't remember a whole lot about Tony Santos, to be honest with you. So obviously he's not going to help me draw any kind of house. Tommy Gilbert is a great little worker out of the western side of Tennessee, works over there for Jerry Jarrett a lot. And you're going to see a few Jerry Jarrett guys starting to show up on some of my Knoxville cards, because we're creating this tighter relationship built around Johnson City and some other things. So Tommy Gilbert is going to help me a little bit that night. Dale Lewis is going scheduled to wrestle that night against Jerry Lawler. Great match right there. You know, that's a big one for fans. But Jerry doesn't show up, you know, and we still have that problem every once in a while. It's not as bad as it was with dealing with Nick and Roy, but Jerry doesn't show up. Dennis Condrey. I find Dennis Condrey, who is working for me quite a bit. He's a young guy. He's going to be a big, huge star. He's going to be a Midnight Express guy, going to be big name. But he's young. So he's going to sub, and he's going to take Lawler's place. Then there's a Tennessee Tag Championship match with Nelson Royal and Les Thatcher against Dutch Mantell and John Foley. Talk a little bit about that match in a minute. And then the main event is Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, yours truly, against Jackie Fargo. Tremendous guy. Tremendous talent. Big name wrestler, okay? So it's not a bad card. But compared to the last two cards, it's not a great card either, you know. Obviously, as I mentioned, Rocky's a great worker. Tommy Gilbert's a great worker. Dale Lewis is going to have a pretty decent match with Dennis Condrey, but then he's going to step up and do something that's really important on the nights like this. There's five guys that show up that night for the $1,000 challenge, and he's going to line them up standing there in the corner and beat all five of them, besides beating Dennis Condrey. That helps my card. It helps the matches that night, too. That's really important to me. These $1,000 challenge matches are becoming just as popular as the regular card. And I'm not paying these guys. They're volunteering to come in there and get stretched and scratched up and mat burned and all the things you go through as a young wrestler. So that's a pretty good deal for me. Then Thatcher and Royal, they're going to work against Mantell and Foley, and they haven't worked with them in 3 weeks. Mantell and Foley are the tag team champions. So this is a tag team championship match. These are my two top teams. They needed to be put back together on this card, and I was booked to wrestle the great Jackie Fargo, but I already worked with him 2 weeks in a row in December. I expected the house was going to drop. When I see the card, I'm thinking this house is not going to withstand, that big house that we've been drawing for the last two weeks. But then I decided to put that booker's hat on and create a change in that card on TV that was going to make all the difference that night. And instead of dropping off significantly from the two shows prior, we're going to fill that building again with what I do on television.
Well, Ron, before we get to that big angle, and I won't spoil the main event until we get there, but let me go over the rest of the card real quick, and I want to thank Tim Dills for sending in all the newspaper clippings from Knoxville from your time promoting Southeastern, so this is going to be a real benefit for the show going forward. But real quick, Rocky Smith defeated Davoy Brunson, Tony Santos lost to Tommy Gilbert, Professor Dale Lewis beat Dennis Condrey, Nelson Royal and Les Thatcher retained the Tennessee tag titles after battling John Foley and Dutch Mantell to a no decision. And of course, that was the undercard with you in the main event, and I know you'll get there, but one last thing I want to ask you. That was the results in the newspaper ad building up the show, saying, you know, the show is tonight at Chilhowie Park. Tommy Gilbert's opponent was listed as the Scorpion. Was there a Scorpion? Did you have someone that was wrestling for you as the Scorpion?
Not that I remember. You know, I mean, we're talking a long time back, and sometimes my memory about particular matches for sure is difficult for me. And a lot of the guys, as I mentioned, Rocky Smith's a star. Tommy Gilbert's a star. But when they're wrestling against guys that aren't stars, I'm likely not to remember exactly who it was. I wouldn't know who the Scorpion was. But I remember back in those days, you did what you had to do. And sometimes you had guys that wouldn't show up at the last minute. It was just part of wrestling. Some guys weren't dedicated to it. Some guys didn't live it. And those guys you didn't want on your card. So probably you're good when those guys don't show up.
Hey, Ron, one last thing before you get to this big angle. I think the listeners will really find this interesting. The show began at 8:30 p.m. Chilhowie Parks Arena. And listen to the ticket prices. Ringside, $4, $3.50, and general admission, $2.50 and $1.50. So those are your ticket prices.
Big prices, right? I'm telling you. You know, back in those days, that's pretty much standard across the country. If you were in Florida, as an example, those drink sides are going to be $5, maybe $6. But this is 1975. And the economy is not great in America during this time frame. We're not really kicking butt as a country. And it's pretty much what prices were around most of the country. That eastern side of Tennessee was not known as it's not thriving like Memphis at this point and some cities on the western side of the state. So you had to take all those things into consideration. I'm basically keeping the same price that John Kazana had when I took over the company. I haven't grown to a point to where I'm able to raise the prices, and it would be a mistake for me to raise the prices unless I can offer them something, a much better product. And at this point, the product is getting better, but I'm going to leave those prices there because I want them to come to the building and see it. If they don't see it, then I can't build it. And so I'm trying to get them in that door. And if I can get them in that door and I can show them some great wrestling during the course of the night, I'm going to get them back. And that's where I'm going to end up making my money.
You said the original intended main event was Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, that of course being you, versus the fabulous Jackie Fargo, who you had already wrestled twice in December. That isn't the main event that the fans got that night. How did we get to that show and what happened to that main event?
Okay, so what's happened here is I've wrestled in Knoxville 15 times since I arrived there. By the time I get to February 7th, 1975, I've wrestled Ron Wright only 3 of those 15 matches. And not once in the last 5 weeks have I wrestled Ron Wright at all. I'm not booked against him on that show, obviously, and he's not even on the card, if you notice. He's not even scheduled to wrestle, but he is there for TV. So I'm sitting and thinking, now, what can I do? I've got Ron right here. He's not booked on my card. He's probably over better than Jackie Fargo, to be honest with you. And And I've still not wrestled live on TV. I'm still sitting on the front row of ringside with my pretty blonde secretary, who's actually my wife. Her name is June. And she's taking notes on wrestlers. And I'm constantly verbally abusing her. You know, I mean, I'm trying to be the heel. So, you know, there's a pretty girl, and I'm just really really knocking her big time and treating her very poorly. Now, for 15 weeks, Ron Wright has been falling in love with my secretary. I mean, it's crazy, but, you know, he comments on her every week about his secretary. And he says things like, you know, that secretary of Ron Fuller's, she's mighty pretty. You know, I got my eye on her. He'd say stuff like that, you know, or that secretary deserves a whole lot more respect than what that Fuller gives her. And what he needs is a good old Tennessee dog whooping, you know, some of that stuff. This had been going on for 15 weeks. So he's kind of got his eye, like he said, he's got his eye on her. Right. And so after 3 months of this kind of talk, And he was doing it whether I was wrestling against him or not. He'd be on the show and he's wrestling somebody else, but he'd always say something about my secretary. So he's pretty much obsessed with my secretary. So I'm in return steadily insulting him at the same time. I'm calling him the number one hillbilly. All these people around here are hillbillies. He's the number one hillbilly. And saying things like, you know, he should be taking English lessons to learn how to speak properly. You know, he just... You know, we're back and forth. We've been for 15 weeks, okay? So on this Saturday, February 1st, the Saturday before the Friday night's event, we're talking about Ron Wright. He comes out during the match on TV, and he stands down at the end of the row in which me and my secretary are sitting on, and all eyes in the building are on him because they're wondering, like anybody else would, well, what's he doing? And the camera picks up the fact that he's standing down there at the end of the row, and he's looking, trying to look past me to see her. And so she sticks her head out to, you know, like, what is he doing down there? And the camera catches him winking at her, right? So, you know, and so the crowd's like, they pick up on it too. They see the monitors in the studio and they go like, oh, look, Ron Wright's messing with Ron Fuller's girl, with his secretary. So she gets red in the face, you know, he reeks at her and she gets red in the face. And so I get up and I go start walking over there, you know, like I'm going after him. And he retreats. He goes back into the dressing room and the match continues that I'm watching. And I go back to my seat, but I'm hot about it. So when the match ends, my secretary follows me to the desk with Jim Hess. And I've got my back to the camera and I'm facing Jim Hess. And she's standing behind me. I always made her stand behind me. I wanted her relegated to, you know, you're not equal to me. Get behind me, you know. So I was constantly just really on her big time. So I start right into Ron Wright. You know, I got my back to the camera and I'm talking to Hess and I go, you know, that ugly, rotten tooth hillbilly is out here again, making a fool of himself. And then I ask Hess, I say, do you think he would ever have a chance of being with a real woman like my secretary here? You know, winking and flirting like the idiot he is. How's he ever going to get a real woman? Right. So naturally, Hess doesn't care much for me. So his response was, well, I don't see why not. He's as handsome a man as you are. Oh, I wanted to slap him, right? I wanted to reach over there and slap him. But there's a microphone sitting there for a guest that's going to be sitting at the desk to talk on. And I just grabbed the microphone next to him. And I turn around then to face the camera. And so I give her a dirty look. You know, because I'm already mad because she's kind of got me in a position here where I ain't happy with. And so I say, get behind me. Right. So she walks around behind me. And now Hess is behind me. Behind Hess back in the studio there is the dressing room for the baby faces and the heels. And I'm facing the camera now. And so I move closer into the camera. And I start on Ron Wright again. You know, I say something like, hey, you know, that bald headed hillbilly, he wouldn't know what to do with a real woman like her. And if you're back there in the dressing room, Ron Wright, you need to bring your ugly ass out here right now. You know, so before I finish the line, I'm into the middle of that line. The cameras picks up behind me. The dressing room door that he's in, he opens up and he's got a chair with him. He's got a metal chair with him. And he walks right past Hess's desk and I'm still spouting out there. You know, I hadn't even finished my line yet. And he comes out the door. The camera picks it up. The fans see him coming and they start to react right away. And one of the cameras gets a shot of him sneaking up behind me. And as I'm continuing to insult him, he rears back and hits me in the back of the head with that chair. And he knocks me on my face underneath the camera that's in front of me and face first into the floor. Now, my secretary's standing there and then she's startled. You know, and she stares at him like, you know, what the heck's going on? And he grabs her. He puts his arms around her. He leans her back slowly toward the floor. And in a move straight out of the movies, he plants a big kiss on her. And the crowd pops. They're like, oh, my God, he's kissed his secretary. Right. So he stands her back up. And she gives him a big smile, like she liked it, right? And the crowd pops again, like, oh, man, she liked it, you know? And then he passes by Hess on his way back to the dressing room, and he leans in toward the microphone, and he says, why don't you ask her if I know what to do with a real woman? So he gets another pop. Crowd hears it. And, you know, it ain't just the crowd in the studio that's popping. They're popping at home, man. Everywhere they're watching this show, this is like crazy for. So, and I get up slowly and I'm holding my head and I go to the desk and I start screaming, man, I'm mad. Now, who the hell does he think he is? And everybody in the studio is just going crazy now. I mean, I start pounding on his desk and screaming, I want him to change the card for Friday night. I will not wrestle Jackie Fargo. I will only wrestle that number one hillbilly Ron Wright this Friday night. I'm going to teach that ignorant redneck a wrestling lesson he'll never forget. And then I said, I've something else he can kiss on Friday night. And I look at the camera and I turn my back and slap my butt and say, you can kiss this, Ron Wright. And then I storm off, right? Well, and when I storm off, my secretary don't go with me. And she's just standing there. She's still got a grin on her face. So I got to come back and get her by the hand. And I go, what in the hell is wrong with you, right? And I jerk her by the arm and I drag her out of there, right? So the crowd's just going nuts. The crowd is just absolutely wild. This is the greatest thing they've seen. And then Wright comes back out to the desk as soon as I'm gone. And Hess says, do you accept his challenge for Friday night? And Wright says, I'll take that challenge, but only if the winner gets the secretary. So the crowd pops again, and he walks away, and I run back out to the set, and I scream, okay, the winner gets the secretary, but his kissing days are over because I'm going to break both his arms Friday night. And that's it. The next Friday night, we have another sellout, and we get it with just a kiss.
From the Knoxville newspaper covering this event, the headline, Fuller Holds On. Ron Fuller was counted out defending his Southern Heavyweight Championship Friday night, but so was his opponent. Challenger Ron Wright and Fuller knocked each other out, with Fuller retaining the title at Chilhowie Park. And that sets up everything for next week, Ron.
Yes, it does. I know, great little angle. Like I said, put on the old Booker's hat. I felt really good about it. We come back with we follow a world championship night and a Andre the Giant event with a regular card, and we come back and sell it out again. I was really proud of that. And, I'm feeling like at this point that I've done the right thing. I've come and started my own company, and maybe I'm going places.
As we begin to wrap things up, we want to remind you that you can become friends with Ron on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. All you have to do is like that page, and boom! Automatically, you're friends with the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Twitter and Instagram, at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter, at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk, and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. We mentioned it earlier, Super Studcast number 15, another great one, with Ron's 10 most memorable matches. Fans are really loving this one, and you can too, right now, at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. It only costs $2.99 to get in the door and access 3 hours plus of old school wrestling history each and every month. Stay tuned for more content soon coming to patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week? You set things up beautifully, but where are we going?
Well, I'm going to defend my Southern Heavyweight Championship against possibly the greatest wrestler and NWA champion of all time, against Luthez. You got to be stupid as a young guy to think you're going to beat Luthez. I'm at this point feeling my oats, man. And so I'm going to take on one of the absolute greatest of all time. And we're going to talk a little bit about I'm formulating a plan that's going to be extremely successful for me in my Southeastern operation that involves wrestling in high schools throughout the small cities around Knoxville, all throughout Tennessee. I'm going to use this everywhere I go for the rest of my career as a wrestling promoter. And it's pretty beautiful idea, and it really is going to become effective for me. We're going to go there with that, and we may get into some other things as well.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.